Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be hosting today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite all students to go next door to our office or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Relevance of Finance, Historically and Contemporarily. I'll now introduce you to today's moderator, Max Stiefel, who's the president-elect of the Economic Student Advisory Committee. Please join me in welcoming Max.
All right, welcome everybody. Is this working or should I just, I don't need it. Thank you for joining us on this sunny Wednesday. It's a little bit better weather than the past 2 days. So we've invited Dr. Lance Girton, Dr. Jihan Bilgensoy, and Dr. Korkut Ertuk, who will hopefully be arriving shortly, to talk about finance in the global economy and give us some insights into capital development from an economics perspective. We did invite finance professors to come and join us, but unfortunately they were unwilling, which is too bad, but hopefully next time we can figure that out. So I'll let each of them introduce themselves, maybe say a little bit about their background in finance or whatever they'd like. So, Dr. Girton.
My name is Lance Girton. A PhD from the University of Chicago. I worked for the Fed and Citicorp, now Citigroup, over the years. I've been a consultant on financial affairs and published some articles on international financial and monetary affairs. And been a professor here at the U for a very long time.
Good morning. My name is Jihan Bilgensoy, and I've been at the U for 20 years now. I would like to thank the Max and the economic sector invite me. I've not really know a whole lot about this thing. Okay, I just have a passing interest in the history of it, and so I'm happy to share, give you the benefit of my ignorance, and I'm happy to listen to Professor Girton and also Professor Korkut, I hope, because they are the real experts. They have written a lot. I do most of my work in macroeconomics and labor economics, and I have been teaching a course called Manias, Panics, and Crashes, which focuses on the history of financial crises since 1600s, which is fun to read because it's colorful history.
All right. Thank you. Welcome them again. It's great to have them here. All right. So our first question is, historically, did finance contribute to... Oh, sorry. I'll let Jane figure out the microphone. So did finance contribute to capitalist development? And maybe Professor Girton would like to start.
Well, I'll defer to Sian. You said history and crisis and so on.
I should have spoken so early. Well, the short answer is, yeah, of course it does. I mean, if you look at the emergence of capitalism and emergence of the industrial society, that required lots of infrastructure investment. It required huge amounts of capital to be put together, and there was hardly any private individuals who can put up with that amount of money. And I'm talking about things like canals and railways, and in order to build that infrastructure, it was necessary to put together funds across the society, and the joint stock companies, okay, which emerged in the 17th century, were very important instruments of building that infrastructure. So without finance, we couldn't have had capitalism, that's for sure. The more interesting question is, however, okay, how well did finance perform this function? For instance, in England, okay, during the building of railways, which was funded by selling shares, it was the unfettered market system, and as a result, the railways were built in a very haphazard, arbitrary fashion. And the similar thing happened in the U.S. as well. Okay, without floating bonds in the European markets, it would have been impossible to build the U.S. railways. Okay, that's where all the money came from. So financial markets enabled U.S. to build an industrial society as well. But at the same time, if you look at the structure of the U.S. railways, again, okay, especially the Western railways were built in a pretty haphazard fashion. By contrast, if you look at the German railway system, okay, where there was a lot more coordination, in that case, funds were put together and the system was built in a more rational manner as well.
Empirically, there's a strong association between finance and development. I said association, not causation. Doesn't necessarily mean that if a poor country goes out and adopts a modern financial system that they're going to develop, but there's a strong association that financial development goes along with economic development. I expect that we will get into what degree of central planning is best for the economy, works better. Shihan talks about rational central planning or overall planning. The other view is that people individually seeking their own interests and profits and so on will, in the end, do a better job. And I would hope that we'd talk some about modern financial crises. We're coming out of one right now. Has anything been done about it? No. Why not? Well, we should talk, I think, about the connection between finance and politics, money and politics. And it's interesting that we're here at the Hinckley Institute because one of the members of the Institute, a former senator, was at the center of money and politics. They got campaign contributions from the financial institutions and voted against reform. Now, it's not to blame him. He was by no means, I think, the worst. But when we're thinking about how we should design, how we should reform the financial system, and I know mostly about the United States, not other countries, we need to confront that Gordian knot of money, financial contributions, and so on, and politics, if we're to get any kind of reform. For example, people talk about reform and redesigning the system in the absence of thinking about how much money is involved. A fellow who I think talked here several months ago, Dean Baker, has estimated that the too big to fail in the United States is worth $32 billion a year. Over 14 institutions. So that's over $2 billion a year. What do you have to do to take $2 billion away from an institution? Shoot them? I mean, some people think that the financial institutions have a lot of power because they have a lot of money, and that's not exactly the case. They have a lot of money at stake. On the average, $2 billion each for the biggest too-big-to-fail institutions, they get to borrow at too low a rate. How are you going to take that away from them? How can you take $2 billion away from somebody?
So I guess that's it sort of segues into our next question, which is, did finance support or prop up hegemonies or oligarchies? And, you know, you're talking about institutions that are too big to fail, and what was finance's role in creating those institutions? So.
You have no chance.
First of all, I should apologize. I thought I was under the impression you wouldn't be able to get in the building until 11. In response to your question, I think the broader context within which we want to address that is whether finance is made subordinate to the needs of production or vice versa. And the trouble is my microphone. I think I agree with Lance that we have a significant degree of what we technically call regulation capture. The groups that are supposed to be regulated can't, in fact, capture the whole process. And that adds to the challenge. Specifically, in answer to your question, is affirmative, I think. We're dealing with a problem where the market forces themselves cause the market to become dysfunctional. So usually people talk about moral hazard as the problem. In the case of too big to fail, I mean, that would be considered an example of moral hazard. But note that in the case of moral hazard, the problem is lack of competition. Because you're not subject to market discipline, you can do things that are detrimental to your long-term interest and social welfare. But in the particular case of financial crisis, we'll probably come back to that in more detail, the problem was not lack of competitive pressure. On the contrary, the firms, financial firms who engaged in all kinds of risky practices did so because of competition. So it's not moral hazard, but it's something that goes beyond that. It has to do with that interface between money and politics.
Anything else to add?
Yeah, I think it's a very complicated relationship between political hegemony and finance, and it's historically specific as well. For instance, if you look at the Bretton Woods Agreement, okay, that is the statement of U.S. global hegemony, okay? And, well, U.S. was able to implement the rules of the Bretton Woods system because it was the hegemonic power. But at the same time, I guess Korkut would say that the finance was subservient to production, was made subservient to production at the same time. I mean, it was heavily restricted. International capital flows were heavily restricted, and finance didn't have much of a voice in what was going on, at least until 1958. When Wall Street started pressuring the Congress, okay, to start diluting the restrictions so that the euro dollars could escape regulation from the U.S. to the European to Europe, and subsequently, what happened was that the internal contradictions of the Bretton Woods, in combination with all those euro dollars, okay, brought the end of the Bretton Woods system, and it also harmed the U.S. global hegemonic power at the same time. If you look at the 1980s onwards, on the other hand, now you see the political power becoming more subservient to the financial power. Now you see the Wall Street, okay, making the shots and, you know, putting pressure on the Congress to open the path to globalization of finance, and Washington, okay, following along this path. And there was a lot of money moving around from Wall Street to Washington to enable that. At the same time, there was a revolving door, people moving from Wall Street to Washington and then moving back. And at the same time, you had the Congress, okay, having swallowed lock, stock, and barrel, that liberalization is the best thing that could happen. Now you have the hegemonic power being dominated by the financial power. And then the financial crisis happened, okay, and that is a very interesting thing in itself, because the financial crisis was, to a large extent, was the outcome of Wall Street overextending itself. And that, in a strange way, weakened the U.S. hegemonic power even more, probably. Now, probably that's something we'll come to later. There's greater likelihood that there is greater autonomy across the globe, okay, you know, these pockets, instead of following the model of U.S. implementing their own rules.
Dr. Gritton, anything?
Well, we'll switch roles. I'll talk about U.S. history and the tension between politics and finance. It goes back at least as far as Jefferson, President Jefferson, who opposed Hamilton. Hamilton was a very, very bright economist, but essentially represented the financial and industrial interest, and Jefferson the agricultural interest, and warned against financial power. Jackson, Andrew Jackson, one of the most interesting presidents we've ever had, although you wouldn't want to live next to him, I don't think. He was dangerous. But he warred on the Second National Bank of the United States and destroyed it because he disliked concentrated financial power. The populists in the late 19th century were blamed financial power and concentrated financial power on a lot of the ills, causing a lot of the ills of society. There was a Pujo hearings in the Senate, I think in 1908 or 1907, which was a prolonged discussion of the dislike or fear of concentrated financial power in the United States. And when a few years later the Fed was set up, it was set up as a decentralized institution with 12 district banks, and the Fed at that time, the board at that time was only a review board. And the Secretary of the Treasury under Wilson, who was also his son-in-law, there was a discussion between the two where they would put the Fed, and he put them in a broom closet, essentially. The board of governors met in a broom closet in the Treasury building. Then during the Great Depression, again, concentrated financial power was thought to be the culprit. And then on to, as he talked about, in the last financial crisis. The long history in the United States of fear of Wall Street, fear of concentrated financial interest, fear of the concentrated financial interest dominating the politics of the United States. Goes all the way back to our founding.
So in looking at the 2008 financial crisis and then trying to figure out what the best steps forward are for capital development, do you think that financial institutions are our best tool for continual capital development in the global economy, or is there something else that could replace that?
I think we jumped into what needs to be done without discussing what happened, I guess, but I guess we can come back to it. When we start discussing the question of what needs to be done, I think the crucial question that needs to be answered is whether we think speculative excess is inevitable or not. I think the political and economic elite in this country have answered that question affirmatively. So the whole objective has been to come up with a system that is tolerable to speculative excess. Now, probably all of us might take exception to that view. And the alternative could have been, and probably be more sympathetic with the alternative way of taking that question, that is eradication of speculative excess. Now, that would have led in a very different direction, breaking up banks. For instance, Glass-Steagall, right, that was put in place during the Great Depression, achieved that. So that's the more central issue. I mean, what is it that we're trying to do? In the current situation, because the objective has never been the eradication of speculative excess, but learning to live with it, we're in a precarious situation. I think many of us expect that financial meltdown is another more serious, in fact, financial meltdown is quite probable. So nothing of substance has been done, I heard Len saying as I came in, and that probably shares a similar point of view as this. Not to mean to put words in your mouth, Len.
I do not know if an alternative exists. Okay, we have a financial system, and we are going to continue allocating funds among different projects through the financial system. Okay, I do not see the alternative to that. The real question is what kind of a financial system we are going to have. We are well aware, economists have been well aware of the flaws in the financial system, okay? They range from asymmetric information to externalities, the systematic risk, moral hazard, and excessive risk-taking. So the question is, okay, what, and, well, you know, lots of people, okay, except perhaps for the Austrians, okay, agree that money and credit are commodities that are different from all other commodities. So even Friedman, who would very much like to remove all regulations, even he thinks, say, you have to regulate the banks. You cannot have it any other way. So what we need to talk about is then how we are going to regulate the banks, okay, to ensure that we are not going to face constantly the problems of systematic risk, lack of transparency, and, yeah, those two to start with, I'd say.
I'd say first we have to break up the too big to fail. As long as $2 billion each on the average is floating around, nothing will be done. Now, how do we break up the too big to fail? They got $2 billion at stake, right? I don't know. The hope was, and a great disappointment, was that the financial crisis of 2008 would focus attention enough so that politicians would find it in their interest to go directly for votes by breaking up the too big to fail. Politics is about money and votes. Financial markets about money. And the rest of us are about votes. And the money won and the votes lost. Nothing will be done, I think, now, or it's hard to do anything. You need a crisis. In fact, I think the term crisis is a political term, and it denotes something that's thought to be big enough that you can attract votes by directly addressing the problem. And one would have thought 2008 was big enough, but it turned out not to be. The big banks have gotten bigger, not smaller. Why? Because that's the way they get the insurance. That's the way they get the $2 billion is to be bigger. And we got to break that or very little else is going to work out. There are several things. I do think moral hazard is a big deal. I don't think bankers are big risk takers. The ones that I've known, afraid to play golf because it's too big a risk. But they're rewarded for taking big risk. They're rewarded for taking big risk because they have explicit and implicit insurance. Depositors insurance. I'll be real radical. I think we should have on checkable deposits, transactions deposits, 100% reserves instead of 10% reserves. Too big to fail insurance should be done away with. And then I think risk-taking would go down. Is Glass-Steagall, reimposing Glass-Steagall, a good idea? I think probably so. I would have thought not before 2008, but I learned something. It probably a good idea. At any rate, you don't want banks taking risk with insured deposits. Look, insured deposits or government insurance is like giving you a Xerox machine to print government debt. And if somebody gave you a Xerox machine to print government debt, I hope you wouldn't be modest. You'd print a lot of it. And you wouldn't invest the proceeds in treasury bills. You'd invest the proceeds in something riskier so that you make a spread. We got to get away from that. Now, if magically we got rid of the moral hazard, the incentives to take too much risk from the various insurance schemes, would we then have too speculative an economy? Would the financial system be too speculative? I don't know. I think not. But we need to get rid of the problems, the obvious problems that are causing it, the insurance. That when bankers take losses, we bail them out. When they make gains, they stick it in their pocket. And that's going to make people take additional risk. You, me, anyone else? Yeah.
Dr. Artuk, did you have something?
Yeah. While I agree that moral hazard is an issue, the real problem, in my view, if we're supposed to pin down just one central issue, is something different. And that has to do with capital requirements. Now, any financial system is unique and poses challenges from the point of regulation. But the central difficulty is, how do you prevent individual financial institutions from profiting by means of taking on greater risk? See, that was the problem during Great Depression. Glass-Steagall Act was effective in fixing that problem. And with the deregulation, we returned to the same issue. Now, the Basel process, which I'm assuming most of you know, which instituted capital requirements as early as 87, or was it 88, and then Basel II and so forth, the whole process of deregulation was based on two premises. A, when we deregulate financial markets, the risk would be diversified and it would be spread out optimally. And secondly, the second misconception, as it turned out, was that the banks are in a good position to know how much capital need to back up their liabilities. I think those two propositions have proved to be tragically wrong. And the crisis, in my view, from a long point of view, is how financial institutions over time managed to reduce their skin in the game, which is their own network, their own capital. That's the central difficulty. You see, you make profits by taking on greater risk, and part of that risk is private risk, and that's where the moral hazard issue becomes, because it's insured itself too. But the other issue is systemic risk. You get rewarded, but part of the risk cost is borne by the society. It's not a moral hazard issue. So many of these firms were capable, it was so profitable to engage in risky affairs because no one was bearing the cost of systemic risk that they were contributing to. So that's a central issue that didn't get fixed. And I would put more emphasis on the ability of firms to get a competitive advantage by taking on greater risk as the more serious problem. Now, moral hazard is clearly part of this, but even without moral hazard, we would have that difficulty unless we pin some kind of a leverage ratio that forces banks to have a strict capital requirement.
If I may, I want to appropriate your role and ask a question to Lance. How exactly are we going to get that crisis that is going to help us to fix it? I'm serious. I'm not being facetious. I mean, we thought we had a huge crisis, okay, and that's not going to go to waste.
But it went to waste.
It went to waste, and it went to waste because essentially the Fed and the Treasury and everyone else was effective, okay, in isolating this thing and, you know, covering up and putting out the fire at least for a while, okay, or entombing it in a way.
I understand your question. I have no answer. I mean, that was a big crisis, and it wasn't big enough, I guess. So something got done, raising people's consciousness, what we're doing here, vote the bastards out of office. But your question's a good one, and I have no answer, right? I mean, we wasted a very good crisis. I'd like to respond a little bit to Corkett. Traditionally, banks were partnerships, like the old law firms and the accountings and so on. In fact, the Bank of England, their charter, made them the only, I believe, limited liability bank in England. All other banks were ones where if the bank failed, they took the partners down to their socks. I think in that situation, there wouldn't be excessive risk-taking, maybe not enough risk-taking. So that the excessive risk-taking, I think, that Corkett is talking about is not because bankers somehow are chosen because they're high flyers and big risk-takers. Probably the opposite is the case. They operate in a system where they have been able to appropriate most of the winnings and foist the losses on the taxpayer. That system needs to change. Now, I wouldn't recommend going back to banks being partnerships. But banking and finance, certainly, there has to be an institutional structure that enforces contracts, regulates banks, and so on. I think that's economists like me got a learning experience out of 2008 that the regulatory structure is extraordinarily important and it can very badly screw up the incentive system in banks. My guess would be if we got rid of moral hazard, and I don't know how to do it. I mean, a really big crisis, I guess. I don't know how to do it. We really missed a golden opportunity. But if we don't get rid of the incentives to take excessive risk, nothing will be done. How would you like to be a bank regulator where if you regulate the banks, the typical bank, you're taking $2 billion a year away from them? That is a very hard job, taking $2 billion on the average away from somebody. Regulators are not going to be up to the task. Politicians will be bought off. God, that's a negative message, isn't it? Vote.
For who? It was quite bipartisan, the whole process of deregulation.
Yeah. Run.
So I guess are there some bipartisan opinions that can be brought together in order to create a coalition in between Republicans and Democrats that could potentially regulate the financial system?
No, all the politicians are bought off.
Unfortunately, it's bipartisan in the other direction.
Yes.
But politics, I'm an economist, so I can talk about politics, right? It's money and votes. And the banks have, the financial institutions have the money. Again, it's not that they have so much money, it's that they got so much money at stake. But we have the votes. And if we convince politicians that they can reject the money from the financial institutions and that we'll vote for them, then something can be done. If that is not the case, then very little can be done. And it's not that all regulators are bad. A lot of them were trying to do something, but they were steamrolled. Part of it is, I think it's notable that the finance professors wouldn't join us here. They're part of it in selling you on how complicated finance is. It's simple. It's really simple. TVs and cars are complicated. Finance is all about return and risk and a couple other things. Now, what makes it complicated is the lack of information, the uncertainty. And that's to some extent irreducible. So that banks and the financial markets are dealing in an environment with a lot of uncertainty, making decisions in a lot of uncertainty. That makes it somewhat complicated, but the products itself, themselves, are very simple. We should be able to understand them. They're hiding it. The issues in voting are very simple. You want to get rid of moral hazards. You want to get rid first of too big to fail. That's got to go. They've got to be broken up, or nothing else, is, in my estimation, will happen.
So in looking at the perceived complications of the financial services industry, are there any financial instruments that you would recommend we remove from the system in order to, I mean, it seems we want a global collapse, but saying that we don't want a global collapse is probably more amiable to most people. So are there any certain financial instruments that you would recommend removing?
Well, I actually worked in structured finance in the mortgage market 25 years ago, so I'm guilty. But I do know a little bit about financial institutions or financial instruments and how to design them. And, no, take an example, credit default swaps. That is a simple instrument, and it's a very good instrument. But it was created in an institutional regulatory environment where the works were hidden. As a credit default swap is, you want to buy a bond, you can separate out the default risk from other risks. A specialization division of labor. It's a good idea, very good idea. But they were sold on an over-the-counter market, an unregulated market, in the face of incentives to take additional risk, they blew up. Did the Fed know that much of the counterparty risk was at AIG, the big insurance company? I don't really know, but I don't think they did. I actually don't think the regulators knew that all that risk, all the writer of a lot of those things was one institution, AIG. Maybe they did. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not telling you I know. But I doubt they did know, and they had very little incentive to find out. And they might have had little ability to find out. Information is important in regulating financial affairs. And an old friend of mine wrote a book recently where he argued that we should have a central regulator or central figure who would just be an information provider. That's the only responsibility. They'd be an information provider. Barth is the name of the author. And how would you like to have that job? I wouldn't want that job. You'd have to give me a gun for that job, and I'd have to have the right to shoot the first person who didn't return my calls, because you wouldn't find any information out. That person is not going to. Is going to have a very rough life. You call somebody up to ask them, well, what the hell's going on? And they're out to lunch or they're on vacation or whatever, right? Information is a big deal. We need, as somebody mentioned, transparency. We need more transparency. But the instruments themselves, they're benign, I think. In fact, most of them are designed to meet customer needs. But, for example, the credit default swaps, as it worked out, was a very bad idea because of the lack of information, the lack of regulatory control, and so on.
Dr. Artuk.
The case of credit default swaps, the central problem was, again, no capital requirements. Many credit default swaps were used. It was literally selling insurance, right? An insurance company would normally be obligated by law to put aside a certain amount of reserves against expected losses. But the case of credit default swaps and AIG and so forth, they didn't have to put any capital for.
That's the reason they call them swaps.
Right. So there was this delusional state. And, in fact, many of those practices would have been illegal under state law. And that's why the 2000 law, which I forget, Financial Markets Modernization Act, what have you, had to be passed to make it unlawful to try to regulate credit default swaps. It was insanity. So, again, the crucial issue, though, credit default swaps made the system, financial system, to reduce the overall amount of capital and thereby increase their rate of return, right? Financial institutions' rate of return. And that was the central problem. In other words, it was like an inverse pyramid. A smaller amount of short-term liabilities began to shoulder an ever-rising amount of long-term debt, if you like. And as long as expectations were positive, you had liquidity and things seemed to work fine. But the minute prices of assets stopped rising and so forth, liquidity disappeared and that pyramid collapsed. So because the amount of capital that was financial institutions had in the game was so thin that they became insolvent. And the policymakers treated it as a liquidity problem rather than an insolvency problem, which froze it, as Jian was saying. They put out the fire, but that problem of insolvency never went away. That's why we have still a fragile system.
I agree with you to some extent. I mean, what really happened was that the banks could buy credit default insurance, credit default swaps, against the risky assets, and the Fed then allowed them to reduce the capital held behind these assets. The Fed could have done otherwise. I think the Fed tried, maybe, to do otherwise. You understand? That bank has a loan to General Motors. They can go out in the market and they can buy an instrument that will insure them against default by General Motors. They take that to the Fed and they say, this is no longer a risky asset, or at least it's not exposed to default risk, so can we reduce our capital requirement? And the Fed, in the end, said yes. The Fed could have said no.
And whoever taken the liability or default risk is not putting any capital either.
Well, but that was the Fed's concern.
Right.
Had the insurance writer had enough capital in the game to pay these off, then they would have been happy to allow the banks to hold less capital. But I think the Fed, or at least some of the people at the Fed, saw that these credit default swaps, this was fake insurance, because the insurance company AIG, or whoever was writing them, at least they didn't know that they had enough capital. They resisted to some extent, I believe, writing down the amount of capital the banks could hold, but they were steamrolled. But what if banks and other actors in the financial markets both got the gains and also had to pay the losses? Then they would have examined. You buy insurance on your house, I hope you pay a little bit of attention who you're buying it from. If not, I'll sell you insurance from your house and I'll hold no capital behind it, then you pay me, and when your house burns down, tough luck, right? So why would a banker, these guys may be greedy, but they're not stupid, why would they buy insurance that won't pay off? Because it was a facade. It was a facade because of moral hazard and so on. That is, they could reap the benefits and not bear the cost. If the bankers, if all the way along the line, were going to bear the cost, but bearing the cost means they've got to have some capital, they've got to have some skin in the game, then they would have acted very differently. We need to change that.
There's one additional thing you need to pay attention to. When people talk about insurance in the financial markets, it's very different from the insurance, home insurance or the life insurance you buy, in addition to the capital requirements, okay, when the insurance company sells you life insurance, okay, they look at the actuarial tables and they try to estimate the likelihood of you dropping dead. And the law of large numbers apply, and you know, they determine their premiums accordingly. When you talk about these financial instruments, okay, the likelihood of these things failing, okay, the likelihood of defaults and so forth, there's a lot and lot of uncertainty there, and there's no counterpart to actuarial tables real insurance companies use. And one thing we know that they underestimated the likelihood of default, okay, and they totally underestimated the likelihood of systematic problems, okay, when they were selling these credit default swaps. And that's why they got caught.
I think it's not that bad. That, in my estimation, the Fed, ultimately, as the lender of last resort, should ensure financial markets against the most extreme systemic risks. They're absolutely right. I mean, depositors insurance, for example, it's like insuring a neighborhood of houses next to a national forest, right? Either all the houses are going to burn down or none of them are going to burn down. Either a lot of banks fail or very few banks fail. So the actuarial problem is certainly somewhat different. But in the modern economy, with active monetary policy and so on, the Fed, which it has done to some extent since 2008, is it stepped in and ensured the system against a systemic meltdown, which I think is quite appropriate. Once that happens, once you have that level of insurance, social insurance provided by monetary policy will flood the market with liquidity in order to prevent a system failure. Then depositors insurance and how you ought to price it is not such a huge problem. It certainly is without the lender of last resort function of the central bank.
So I'm going to jump a little bit. We have one more question, and then we'll open up the panel to questions from the audience. But I'll preface it with the fact that the financial crisis of 2008 impacted developing countries to a greater extent than it did the developed countries in general. And considering that financial institutions, the large financial institutions, are centered in the developed countries, and of course they do business in the developing countries. Do you feel that finance is equitable in capital development in these developing countries as well as in emerging economies?
Who would you like to begin?
Anyways, Korkut, you can start if you'd like.
It's anything but equitable. but that doesn't say much, because what we have to have some benchmark against which to compare, I guess. Here's the issue. When we look at the financial system from a global point of view, I think the crucial observation is that the United States financial system functioned as world's bank. Now, what does that mean? That means that the United States collected short-term funds from the rest of the world, just like a bank sells short-term instruments, which are deposits, right, to savers. And then it functioned as an entrepot, meaning these funds were then invested long in another set of countries, the rest of the world. So I think as early as the Asian crisis, or following the Asian crisis, this international or transnational intermediation started running into difficulty. I think there was a collapse of investment globally, and then we had excess savings. And it became increasingly difficult to channel funds out of the United States because of currency crises and increasing risk that long investment the rest of the world entailed. So the way I understand the real estate boom is really it made possible this international intermediation to go on for another number of years by basically absorbing that fund, those funds that would have been invested elsewhere, having them absorbed in the United States by excessive household consumption. So the failure of regulation, if you like, and the excessive credit creation in the United States was perversely functional, because U.S. household consumption filled a gap. So from that global point of view, the challenge is how do we see to it that world savings finance development investment rather than speculative consumption booms here and there, which are bound to blow up.
Well, one thing post-80s financial system that was imposed by the U.S., to much of the rest of the world, either directly or indirectly through the international organization, was the liberalization of short-term capital flows. And the hot money could flow in and out very fast, and that made the likelihood of contagion higher, and that caused much of the third world countries highly susceptible to financial crises. In that sense, I do not know if it is an question of being equitable, but they made those countries more fragile financially.
My understanding is the 2008 crisis had a relatively smaller impact on the developing countries. But in a broader sense, I agree that it's a disaster of the last two or three decades that the rich countries have had net capital inflows and the poorer countries have had net capital outflows, many of them. That's a disaster. That's a very bad thing, long term. Independent of whether the 2008 had a bigger impact on developing countries or not. Long term, if we're going to have a world where there's development more spread out, then one would certainly hope that the expected rate of return is higher in the poorer countries than it is in the richer countries. And that has not been the case. Now, why this hasn't been the case, I would blame the developing countries to some extent, or their institutions. But it's a disaster. It's been a disaster. I remember in 1980 that the World Bank was projecting, and over the next decade, that there would be that Africa as a whole would run a current account surplus. That sounds good, doesn't it? It's a disaster. That means they were going to run a capital account deficit. They were going to be paying off. They were shipping funds out. Now, nobody believes those sorts of projections from the World Bank, but actually it turned out to be true. And the 80s were a disaster for Africa. That sort of thing. The world's not working right. The funds should be going from the rich countries to the developing countries, and then they'll develop and get convergence. And that hasn't, that an overview in the last 20, 30 years, that much of the time that funds have been going the wrong way to the United States. Not only come into the United States as an intermediary, that's not necessarily bad, but coming into the United States and staying in the United States, supporting, as Corkett said, high levels of unsustainable levels of consumption and so on in the United States at the expense of investment in developing countries.
Well, I think we're going to have to end on that positive note. but if anyone has any questions.
And if you do have a question, please state your name and something about yourself into the microphone.
Hello, my name is Satine. I'm a political science pre-med major here at the university. And my question for you is, well, all of you, I guess, what was the role of economists like from Harvard University and Columbia and Yale that were commenting on the financial state before the financial crisis? So, you know, saying that I know that Glenn Hubbard, who I think was like the dean of Harvard Economics, commented saying that everything was fine. A lot of different people were saying things were fine, and they weren't.
My name is Stephen, and I also have a question about...
We're going to let them answer.
Hindsight is better than foresight for all economists. And certainly mainstream economists didn't do very well in predicting 2008.
They were complicit in this scandal. I mean, they were cheerleading all the way through. And one of the main engines of what happened was the economists coming up with mathematical financial models, okay, that show the more extensive use and proliferation of all these derivatives are going to make the markets deeper, and they are going to make the markets work more efficiently. And the more efficiently they work, the better job markets are going to do to allocate funds across different projects and to manage risk. And, their models failed.
I also agree that they were complicit. If you haven't watched it, you should definitely watch that documentary called Inside Job on this. It's a nice documentary for a number of the reasons, but... It gives a really nice view of the complicity of the big-name economists.
And Glenn Hubbard stars in that movie.
There's an interview with him and the interview with the head of the Harvard Economics Department.
And also Mishkin, Fred Mishkin from the Fed. He was at the Fed then.
Okay, so we have time for one more question.
Hey, so my name is Stephen. I'm an economics student here at the university. And you mentioned that throughout history in the 50s that finance was subsidiary to the real economy, and it really seems in the past 10 years that the real economy has become subsidiary to finance instead, and so that's flipped. With the proposed, increased capital requirements, increased information, would that be enough to make the real finance subsidiary to the real economy?
Well, I would say that finance became, the real economy, the subordination of real economy to finance started in 1980. That's not in the last 10 years. Whether the finance is going to be pushed to the background the way it was, it happened in 1930s, okay, after people start complaining that it has gotten way too powerful, okay. Whether that's going to happen or not, I do not know. At this point, the financial sector is still fighting tooth and nail against any loss in its power, and they seem to have very strong allies in the Congress as well. So, in that sense, we miss this crisis to push finance to where it belongs, really, which is facilitation of capital accumulation, rather than being the leading sector in the economy.
Yeah, well, I don't know about dominating, but the size of the financial system, the profits and so on, relative to the rest of the economy, have gone up substantially in the last 20 or 30 years. It needs to be reduced. The financial system is too big. It's why? Because it's been subsidized. Do we have too many automobiles? Is the automobile industry too big? Well, I think so, because of the subsidies through subsidized highways and so on, that we need to strip out the subsidies to the financial system, and the profits and the size will go down. It's too big, too powerful politically.
I think the main problem is lack of political will. I mean, there are clearly technical issues, breaking down banks, capital requirements, and all those things are important. But what's the main objective of reform? And that's where the real difficulty is. I don't think the main objective of reform is eradication of excess speculation and basically making finance subordinate to real economy. That's where the real problem lies.
All right, if everyone could join me in thanking Professors Gurdon, Bilgensoy, and Ertug.